Good evening. You're listening to the Parliament of Rooks podcast, episode 35, When Worlds Did Collide. That day.
That's not me. I go.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Parliament of Rooks podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Lanise.
And this is his wife, Melanie Lanise.
And this time, it actually really is a welcome back. We took a couple weeks off, and I think we sort of like hinted on this at episode 34. But last time we were recording, you know, you might have heard our voices getting a little, you know,
weak.
Gravelly weak. Yeah, exactly. You know, going into the Thanksgiving week, you know, we had a bit of a road trip up north, and, you know, that little bit of a cold we had actually turned into kind of a major cold, you know, the next week.
Yep.
So unfortunately, you know, we had to do a skip week. But like we said, you know, at the very beginning, this round, you know, for volume two, you know, there probably are going to be a couple weeks like that. You know, a weekly schedule, you know, I think is a little bit aggressive, you know, given how busy our lives have become, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So we'll try as best as possible, like I say, to maintain the weekly thing. But occasionally, you know, we're going to have some gaps. But we're back now, and, you know, what better character to come back with than a character who himself came back from the dead, that is. But not, in fact, Dead Man.
Oh, so Spectre then.
Spectre, exactly. And what I was hoping to do, actually, with this episode, and, you know, and I think we kind of, like, were alluding to this, you know, when we were wrapping up our last Dead Man episode, is that I'd kind of like to compare and contrast the two.
Okay.
You know, obviously, you know, very similar in nature, you know, to Revenants, you know, of the late 60s, but very different, you know, in the way that, you know, DC, you know, approached their characterization. For our show, you know, we've basically said informally, you know, our volume two is going to, you know, focus on the Bronze Age.
Mm-hmm.
But as you'll see, I think tonight, you know, the Bronze Age itself isn't actually a hard and fast thing. You know, like, you can't say like, oh, you know, January 1967, the Bronze Age started, you know, and it lasted until, you know, April of 1985 or whatever.
Is it in dispute then?
Well, it's not so much in dispute. It's just more sort of like nebulous. It's really just like kind of a matter of opinion. It's not, it's not really an official designation to begin with. I think, you know, the only place that they really use it, you know, as a strict guideline would be something like, you know, the Comic Buyer's Guide or the like, price, you know, things like that or whatever. But as far as, you know, like, stories and writers and artists and so on and so forth, it's really more like fan opinion. Like, for our purposes, you know, because we're focused on magic, you know, I thought, you know, a good line of demarcation would be the introduction of Dead Man, simply because the narrative style and the artistic style, you know, with the advent of Neil Adams, sort of heralded something that was distinctly different, you know, from what we had looked at in the Silver Age. But a lot of other people define it differently. You know, I think traditionally, you know, if you had to say what the majority of people would cite as, like, the beginning of the Bronze Age for DC, it probably would have been the arrival of the writer-artist, you know, Jack Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because, you know, up to that point, you know, obviously he was mostly known for his Marvel work. All the, you know, sort of Marvel Age characters, you know, with the exception, like, you know, obviously of Spider-Man and, you know,
Doctor Strange.
And Doctor Strange, exactly right. We talked about a couple weeks ago, you know, were Ditko characters. But everything else, like all the sort of Marvel cinematic stuff, you know, Iron Man and, you know, Hulk and, you know, Thor, all that, you know, really, you know, Jack Kirby type stuff. So him coming over to DC was a huge deal or whatever. And so, like, in retrospect, a lot of people go, that's truly the beginning of the Bronze Age, you know. And additionally, you know, that year, 1970, when he came over, was also when Mort Weisinger, you know, who had overseen, you know, the Superman titles, exactly. That's when he retired. And a lot of those, you know, old sort of, like, Silver Age, you know, ideas that he had pumped in into that, you know, section of DC sort of also went to the wayside. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, if you want to look at it from there, you can say 1970, end of the Bronze Age. Other people, you know, cite a more, like, economic concern. Like, you know, a lot of the comics that, you know, we've been reading are priced at what?
12 cents.
12 cents, exactly. The best, you know, the best 12 cents you could spend or whatever, Teen Beam. But at a certain point, you know, I believe in 1969... you know, the cost of paper's going up, cost of ink, so on and so forth. They had to raise across the board, you know, the price to 15 cents.
Ooh.
You know, yeah. So maybe some people, you know, say that is the beginning of the Bronze Age.
Yeah. 3 cents more bronze.
3 cents more bronze. So, but like I say, you know, for our purposes or whatever, you know, because we're in that little niche of magic or whatever, you know, we are declaring that, you know, our beginning of bronze, you know, is the advent of Dead Man.
Oh, okay.
Certainly, you know, the introduction of Neil Adams, and then right on the heels of that, you know, as we referenced a little bit, you know, during the Doctor Strange review, also Steve Ditko is going to be coming over to DC in like just a matter of months, and that for me also is going to herald, you know, bronze.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, you know, a case could be made, especially given some of the stuff that we're looking at tonight, that silver is still in effect. First and foremost is the presence of Gardner Fox.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically Mr. Silver Age himself,
yes,
you know, is going to be writing, you know, at least the first couple stories here of the Spectre. You know, he had been the author on a lot of the stories that we looked at, you know, in our last volume. When we last left the Spectre or whatever, we took a look at his three showcase tryouts.
Mm-hmm.
That was, let's see, that was issue number 60, 61, and 64, and that was throughout 1966, the Go-Go Check era.
Yes.
You know, it was from what? It was January, March, and then September of 66. But the first issue of The Spectre, you know, his solo series that we're going to look at tonight, actually wasn't until November of 1967.
Well, that's a pretty long gap.
Yeah, it's like
14 months.
14 months, exactly. So, you know, that raises the question then, you know, like, why did it take so long? Yeah. So, I don't know if you remember, you know, I actually had to go back and you know, listen to our Spectre episodes to sort of like ramp up, you know, for this one or whatever. But one of the things that we had remarked upon when we were looking at the final episode, you know, the Ghost of Ace Chance was the letter column. They'd started getting like some feedback or whatever, and it was mostly positive, like, oh, yeah, you know, awesome to see the Spectre again. But there were a couple letters there that, you know, quite pointedly, Mike Friedrich, who I said, you know, would later become a DC writer, and Irene Vartanoff, both made very compelling cases for why the Spectre, although it was nice to see him again, probably couldn't have, you know, any sort of like staying power. You know, I don't know if you recall, but they were citing basically his sort
too
of like...
Too powerful.
Right, his almost like divine type nature.
Yeah.
Like, how can you keep writing stories about this guy who like can defeat anything?
He was fighting Shaltan, for God's sakes.
Right, exactly,
I
yeah.
Mean, what do you do with that?
Basically the devil or like, you know, in JLA, you know, that sort of what, anti-matter man, that big cosmic thing or whatever.
Right.
But you can't really do that month after month, you know? So I think, you know, we'll look at these stories or whatever, you know, with that in mind, you know, and see how they are, you know, going to address that. But to the earlier point, though, like, why now is, I think it's simply a matter of economics. Like, we were saying, you know, the reason DC decided, you know, we got to do something, we got to change, is because Marvel, you know, from 1963 onward, had slowly and steadily been chipping away at their market share. You know, at first it was like, you know, just a little like, you know, buzzy fly or whatever around your head. You're like, oh, go away, Marvel, go away, you know. But like, before you know it, it's
then
like...
Then they had something.
They had something, exactly. Like, you know, on college campuses, everybody's reading Doctor Strange, you know, Spider-Man was...
Well, I gotta start, Doctor Strange was a really good character.
Well, yeah, because he saw the movie or whatever. But yeah, but like I say, it truly was the Marvel age. So I think a little bit, you know, DC was trying to say, you know what, as much as this hurts us, we got to become more like Marvel. So, you know, one of the things that Marvel had in spades was the sort of cosmic approach. You know, like they had street-level guys or whatever, but then a lot of these guys, you know, had backstories firmly rooted in the fantastic. Like, you take a look at, you know, well, you say Doctor Strange, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was doing battle on these astral planes, you know, all these, like, swirly colors, so on and so forth. Thor, right? You know, like, so you have Thor here down on Earth, but he's got that whole Asgardian background.
Right.
You know? Castles and Rainbow Bridge, all that. You probably don't know this character, and I think they gave it short shrift in the movies, but the Fantastic Four, one of their big villains was this dude, Galactus. Do you remember that from the movie?
Not really.
No, like I say, in the movie they kind of like recast it as just this sort of like nebulous cloud. They tend to do that a lot in like superhero movies, just make it like a swirly sky thing. But in the comics, and you know, this is probably why they didn't adapt it, because that's just kind of a ludicrous idea when you think about it. He's this gigantic alien who roams the universe or whatever looking for planets to eat.
Okay.
So yeah, that probably doesn't translate too well to the silver screen. But like I say, DC probably was looking at this going, we need something of that scale, you know, something grand and cosmic, something larger than life. And they're like, you know what? About a year ago, we were doing all that Spectre stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
yeah.
let's roll the dice or whatever. You know, maybe we can't maintain this or whatever, but let's at least give it a shot.
Okay.
So in November of 1967, which... like I think is a couple months into the Dead Man stuff. I'm trying to remember when our first Dead Man story was. I want to say either September or October of 67. But right around that time, you know, Spectre number one debuted. And we are not going to read that full issue, but I did want to at least look at it tonight. As I say, simply to contrast, you know, what we've been seeing in the Dead Man stories.
Okay.
So let me go ahead and pull this one up. So this, you know, as were all the Spectre stories, we looked at a Gardner Fox, Murphy Anderson collaboration. And interestingly, this actually is the last Murphy Anderson work for DC for a couple of years at least. I think he, and you know, it's funny. So we've been doing, you know, on occasion, like creator bios, you know, like writers and artists or whatever. We never actually did one for Murphy Anderson.
Oh. Feels like we overlooked that then.
Yeah, like, and we're not going to do it tonight. I think, you know what, later in this volume or whatever, there's a character called the Phantom Stranger who's actually a joint creation of Murphy Anderson. So I think at that time maybe we'll loop back and do it.
Yeah.
I don't want to give him short shrift. But suffice to say, he sort of went through a creative change at this point. He had been looking at, I guess, the world at large. I think more in particular the Batman TV show, and sort of came to the opinion that comics, you know, the actual printed comics, were sort of on their way out. I think he thought that, you know, like the TV was a herald of, like, you know, a new phase for superhero type things, and he thought like his work there was done. So he
okay.
just, you know, under good circumstance, he didn't get fired or anything. He just parted ways with DC for a couple of years.
Where'd he go?
Actually, it's kind of interesting where he went. I don't know if you would know this because you were a reservist or whatever, but in the Army, we used to get these kind of comic books, I guess. So they're like half comic, half magazine, called Preventative Maintenance Monthly. Do you know that?
It doesn't sound familiar.
No, it was like a little, like, almost like digest-sized magazine, and basically it was like stuff like, you know, how to stay safe in the motor pool and stuff like that, you know, like, you know, don't leave, like, you know, tools lying around and make sure you're always, like, changing your oil and stuff.
So in other words, do your job the way you were trained to do it?
Exactly, right.
<Okay. laughs>
But these magazines were put out by a very famous, comic personality by the name of Will Eisner. And we've mentioned him a couple times. I doubt, are ever going to cover any of his, like, comic work. He's mostly known for a newspaper comic called The Spirit. But post-World War II, he founded his own studio called American Visuals Corporation. And they were the ones who put out this little, like, army mag.
Uh-huh.
So I guess Murphy Anderson had known Will Eisner back in the day or whatever and said, you know, hey, you know, can you throw some work my way? And so, yeah, Murphy Anderson, that is, you know, went to go work for Will Eisner at
mm-hmm.
At ABC making these little army mags.
That's
so
nice.
Just, yeah, a neat little bit of trivia. But that's not what we're looking at tonight. Tonight we are looking at Murphy Anderson's final DC work here, from Spectre number one, as I say, from November 67, The Sinister Lives of Captain Skull. So first things first, let us take a look at the cover, which you see, like I say, you know, is very standard, you know, Murphy Anderson, whatever. You see the sort of like swirly concentric, you know, circles or whatever,
right,
surrounding the Spectre.
Right, because he can't help himself.
Yeah, and then very like Gardner Foxian type characters, right? You know, pulling mm-hmm. from the annals of history, there's all these like sort of historic warriors, you know, doing battle with the Spectre here.
Right. You know, it's kind of weird to think that his last work with DC has a number one associated with it.
Oh, Murphy Anderson?
Yeah, yeah. It seems like, you know, very much like it's the beginning of something.
Yeah, and honestly, like I was saying at the beginning or whatever, you know, like, Can the Spectre make it? I think in very short order, you're going to see, like, you know, maybe not, because there's a lot of, like, shifts in a very short period of time. This is issue number one. As you see, in issue number two, they're going to have a completely different artist. So,
yeah.
You know, so, like I say, we're not going to read, you know, this whole thing, but I just do want to flip through just to, you know, give you, you know, the sort of last bastion here of the Silver Age, you know, Murphy Anderson art. You know, we flip it open and we see, you know, very sort of, like, contrasting, you know, art to what we've been looking at with regard to Neil Adams, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, it's very different, but it's a really, it's a good layout. Because what we're looking at is it's a Spectre and there's a big skull. And then we have two characters, one a historical pirate-looking guy, mm-hmm. and the other's a Spectre. But their heads are right in front of the skull's eyes, and it really makes it pop.
Oh, no doubt. Like, I'm not for a minute saying that Murphy Anderson isn't an amazing artist, you know, but what he is, and I think we've mentioned, you know, here on this show before, is really sort of like, you know, an echo of an earlier time. You know, Murphy Anderson was the choice artist for the reintroduction of all the Earth 2 characters we saw, right? Dr. Fate and Hourman, Starman, Black Canary, you know, mm-hmm. and the Spectre himself, because his art was so similar to those we had seen in the Golden Age.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely top of his game here, but like I say, you know, sort of a dying style, you know, with the advent of the realism of somebody like Neil Adams.
Right, yeah, I mean, it's certainly more simplistic than what we've been seeing lately from Neil Adams.
Yeah, so... So we'll flip through here. You see a little, you know, a couple more, you know, just traditional type, you know, Anderson type things, you know. And then we're not going to read this, whatever, but definitely elements of Gardner Fox, right? Right off the bat, we see that the villain is a, you know, historically placed individual, right? You know, sort of like Corsair type guy, you know, swashbuckly type guy. I did want to pause actually just briefly here on the letters page, the Reader's Rendezvous,
mm-hmm.
Because there was a letter here by a fellow by the name of Joseph Arul that I think speaks to some of what we were talking about with regard to, you know, the tryouts there in Showcase. He begins, "Dear Editor, it was with great pleasure that I confronted the third Showcase Spectre tryout, number 64. I was not disappointed. The Ghost of Ace Chance proved to be an action package. Well written, well drawn. In short, I have no complaints against you, Mr. Editor, or your staff. Solely kudos. However," he says in caps, "I am greatly dismayed and angered by the comments of readers Friedrich and Vartanoff. Dismayed that they could argue against placing the Spectre in his own book, and angered because for years fandom has been bombarding you with pleas to revive the Ghostly Guardian, to which you finally agreed, only to be told by a faction, a small one, I wager, that he's not truly worthy of being resuscitated. And on what grounds do they argue? Mr. Friedrich declares, in regard to Showcase number 60, that nobody can beat a perfect hero, as this issue proved. Or to put it another way, the Spectre is omnipotent, God-powerful. To this I respond, what's wrong with an all-powerful hero? I'm tired of being exposed to super beings with an Achilles heel. Superman succumbs to kryptonite or magic, fire's fatal to John Jones, Green Lantern's ring fails against anything yellow. Aquaman must have water every hour, on the hour, in order to survive. And Wonder Woman goes berserk if her bracelets are removed." I didn't know that about Wonder Woman.
Huh.
Therefore, I think it's high time we had a change of pace. But if Mr. Friedrich had reflected a little longer, he would have spotted Spectre's tender spot, Jim Corrigan. As this issue clearly indicates, if Jim's in danger, so is the disembodied detective, a definite but more subtle weakness. Ms. Vartanoff contends, quote, "How can infinite power fail to triumph over evil? Or to paraphrase, how can the Spectre, symbol of good, ever fail, since we all know that good triumphs over evil? I retort by means of two questions. A, is evil such a weak force to be triumphed over so lightly? In his three encounters with the forces of darkness, did the Spectre win so easily? And B, has good always triumphed over evil in real life? Was the estimated 30 million people killed during the First World War a case of good over evil? No, Miss Vartanoff. Therefore, it's very important that we have this concept, the positive winning over negative on an absolute basis, at least in fiction, to lend hope for the day when it will finally come to pass. Hence, this is why I want to see the Spectre, and for that matter, all the other superheroes, in action. Thus, Mr. Editor, I urge you to continue publishing the Ghostly Guardian, notably in his own book, for despite what these readers have said, I believe that they will continue to buy the Spectre. With his locale on Earth 2 and the possibility of guest starring members of the Justice Society of America occasionally, he will sell many issues, especially if you continue to stress the supernatural angle.
Wow. Well, yeah. Take that, naysayers.
Exactly. Ms. Vartanoff. but it's sort of funny. I mean, I think, you know, and admittedly, I'm looking at this, you know, in 2016 with 43-year-old eyes, that his very points that he's trying to make, you know, against what they're saying are the very reasons, you know, why these people were writing these letters to begin with. He's like, I'm tired of superheroes having weaknesses. We need an all-powerful hero. Really, dude? Like, right. You know, is that going to be something that's going to be maintained issue after issue?
Probably not.
So, but that Wonder Woman thing, that really sort of took me unawares. Yeah. All right, so let's keep flipping. A little bit more Murphy Anderson stuff, you know, traditional, you know, Spectre elongated limbs, you know, very much a trademark here.
Yes.
Let's see.
And big Spectre over there, towering over the buildings.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the gigundous, you know, sort of Galactus-sized Spectre, right? Just getting ready to eat the Earth. So, let's see. A little more flipping. And actually, okay, and this one actually has a second letters page, a Reader's Rendezvous extra, that also had a letter I wanted to take a look at, okay. but for a different reason. This is from, actually, I think we mentioned this guy before, Bob Butts.
Yes.
I thought he was fake or whatever, but no Irene Vartanoff, he's a real dude, apparently, who writes, "Dear Editor, I suppose that after 20 years of inactivity, even a ghost would be slightly affected, but what you've done to the Spectre would be ridiculous if it weren't so pathetic.
Oh, God.
He's, if you'll pardon the expression, only a shadow of his former self. Tell me, whatever happened to that awesome being who could bend every cosmos to his will, who terrified not only those who he fought, but also those he helped, and whose eyes held instant death for those foolhardy enough to peer into them?" He's obviously harkening back to the Golden Age Spectre, right? "This is the character I was hoping you'd revive, not the diluted, unimpressive excuse for a spook we have now. What Gardner Fox has attempted to do is portray the Spectre and the supernatural without the intrinsic bone-chilling terror that pervades both of them. And this just can't be done, although I imagine his hands are tied a bit by the code. Not if his stories are to be worth reading. I know there are self-regulatory measures..." Oh, he's even referencing it. "Yeah, I know there are self-regulatory measures which have to be adhered to, but what I'm trying to say is the Spectre is a character which, by his very nature, cannot and must not be so impeded. He must be a character whose very name invokes fear that is paralyzing, who must be the equivalent of an earthbound death angel." Signed, Bob Butts. So
he knows that they can't bring the Spectre back to his Golden Age self, but he doesn't really care because he's irritated, obviously. Yeah.
So, I mean, what I'm getting, like, from these letters is there is a lot of divisiveness in the fan community about how Spectre should be portrayed, right? On the one hand, they're like, he's supposed to be this death angel or whatever, you know, but on the other hand, they're like, you know, he can't be so omnipotent, you know, because why would we read him? So I don't know that it's an impossibility to do a Spectre story. In fact, I know for a fact it's not. There are two runs of the Spectre later on that I hold up, you know, probably in my, you know, top 20 runs of all time. That being the Wrath of the Spectre by a writer named Michael Fleischer, which you won't remember this, I think, but way back in episode 1, I told you would like it because Spectre comes almost as like, you know, this... spirit of vengeance, where he like punishes criminals by like, you know, the absolute most brutal means, like, you know, chops them up into wood or whatever, like turns them into wax and melts them.
I do remember you telling me that. It was pretty disturbing.
Yeah. I mean, so when we get to that's a great Spectre run, but that's completely distinct take from what we're looking at here. And then much later on, like I say, in the 90s, John Ostrander really delved into the religious aspects of the Spectre, you know, more heady stuff than this or whatever, but definitely a valid take. I think at least in the late 60s, though, they are struggling with, you know, how they are going to do this. You know, so let's just flip through the remainder of issue one. Like Murphy,
the circles.
Murphy Anderson circles, exactly. He's getting the last dregs out of his compass. So a few more things here. Let's go all the way to the back just to the direct currents page. I did want to point this out, though, is because, you know, as I say, trying to sell the Spectre, you know, they made sure in direct currents they're hawking what other character?
Dead Man,
exactly. They're very, very popular, you know, Revenant. All right, so that is it for Spectre number 1. you know, maybe someday, you know, like I say, we want this show to be comprehensive, but I didn't want to, you know, waste a lot of time on another, you know, Gardner Fox, Murphy Anderson tale that doesn't really fit the narrative we're going for. Right. But who knows, maybe someday we'll loop back around this and do more comprehensive coverage. But for now, what I want to do is go to the next month, which is December of 67, and take a look at a Spectre appearance in another title. Now, I want you to give this a little bit of thought. You know, we've talked about this a couple times or whatever, but for this era of not just comic history, but sort of like cultural history in America, you know, sort of 66, 67, who would you wager is probably the most popular character, you know, in DC right now?
It's got to be Batman.
Batman, exactly, right, because of the TV show, so on and so forth. So you would imagine if there is a new character or, like, you know, a character they're attempting to revive, probably a tried and true method to, like, you know, give this character exposure would be to, like...
Team him up with Batman.
Team up with Batman, exactly. And we have looked before at the title, you know, which was sort of, like, spotlighted for doing just that, you know, The Brave and the Bold.
Right.
We had previously looked at the... Batman team up there with Eclipso, you know, an attempt to save House of Secrets. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that didn't work. But in Brave and the Bold number 75, from December of 1967, they teamed him up with the Spectre. So let's go ahead and take a look at that cover. So, yep, so this is a story called The Grasp of Shanzi. And right away, you know, you'll see that the cover here is, you know, much more sort of realistic than the Spectre number one. Yeah, take a guess. Who do you think did this cover?
Neil Adams.
Neil Adams, exactly right. So this would have been the age. I think he hadn't really burst forth yet, but I think this is the early days when, you know, Carmine Infantino was sort of like putting Neil Adams on a lot of like
covers
type stuff. Yeah, exactly. Because he actually does not do the internal artwork in this. It's actually a pair of artists named Ross Andrew and Mike Esposito, probably best known for their Wonder Woman work, and a sort of fringe title called the Metal Men, which was sort of like robots of different metal. It's actually kind of a neat little thing. But the cover here, you know, is Neil Adams' first work, you know, on the Spectre. And that, matter of fact, a bit of trivia, his first work on Batman, who he will later go to draw for, you know, with great renown. This is a sort of historic thing here. You see the Spectre, you know, passing through a wall as apparently Shang-Zi, you know, holds Batman in peril. And so similar to Spectre number one. We just want to sort of flip through this a little bit.
Okay.
Specifically because it's a Bob Haney story.
Oh, lovely. And,
I really don't want to...
It won't make any sense delve anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, we see some sort of nonsense, you know, is it what this is like, the Chinese New Year parade?
Oh, and a smiling Batman.
Right, with a smiling Batman sort of like glad-handing with the mayor and all the populace. It's just
awesome.
It's very weird. Of course, you know, Batman acting.
It's disturbing even not reading the words.
Let's see, what else we got? The Spectre shows up. So, yet again, a Bob Haney type thing because, right, Spectre is from what Earth?
Two?
Earth 2, exactly. You know, whereas Batman, or at least, you know, the Batman we're seeing here, is the Earth 1 Batman.
No, he's Earth B Batman.
I was going to say exactly, like, you know, why is Earth 2 Spectre and Earth 1 Batman palling around? Because it's Earth B.
Right. I mean, like, we're not reading the words here, but I mean, there's arrows telling you where to go. Like, it's just, it looks like such a mess.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that, like, they need to give you some direction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Neil Adams himself will actually do that at some point. He'll actually go ahead and make his panels themselves in the shape of arrows to direct you where to go.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So I think people are beginning to experiment a little with the form. But yeah, I think, you know, Ross Andrew maybe is not the most refined artist to do that. Because he literally, as you say, you know, has arrows, you know, in between the panels to go, like, look here. Let's see. So flip, flip, flip. I don't know that there's so much we want to look at in this one. You know, it was just sort of, you know, to highlight the fact that they are using this as a forum to, you know, publicize the Spectre. You know,
give them more exposure.
Yeah, exactly.
As you were flipping through, though, I have to say that the hand that was on the cover was much better than the hand that I saw on some of the panels.
Well, yeah, it's Neil Adams versus, you know, Ross Andrew. But again, we go to the very back here and we see the direct currents.
Uh-huh.
And again, who's highlighted, you know, as far as an image here?
Deadman.
Deadman, exactly. So, and this was the, what story was that? Was this the one with Lorna's brother, the motorcycle gang, the sea of faces?
So.
Yeah, it's, And then the inside back cover, actually quite nice. This is a full page ad for the benefit of our listeners that pairs Dead Man and the Spectre. Two, neither alive nor dead, destined to stalk the earth on missions that will astound you. Read their daring exploits in Strange Adventures, Spectre, and The Brave and the Bold. But interestingly, who have they given primacy to in this ad?
Dead Man.
Dead Man, right. Dead Man's got the leftmost panel, and when they list the titles, Strange Adventures is listed in the point of primacy as opposed to the Spectre.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of interesting. They're taking their historically huge character and letting him ride on the coattails of a newly introduced popular character.
Nice.
So that then is the tenor, I guess, you know, of the age, which is, you know, introducing the story that we are focusing on tonight. Like I said, I just sort of wanted to give this, you know, these couple issues as background, you know, leading into the sort of convergence, I guess you'd say, of the Silver Age, you know, ethic, you know, with the newly introduced, you know, Bronze Age techniques. Very poignant in this issue, Spectre number 2, from January, February 1968, because it is written by Gardner Fox, but drawn by Neil Adams. So
that'd be interesting.
Yeah, it's like when worlds collide. This is a story called Die Spectre Again. So first things first, let us take a look at that cover, which is both penciled and inked, you know, by Neil Adams, you know, as mm-hmm. is his wont. You know, I think he was only ever inked by, you know, another person one time. And possibly colored by him. The color's not credited for this cover, but I know Neil Adams, at least from a cover perspective, sometimes would do his own colors and letters, and we are definitely getting to the end of this fellow's career as well, by our old friend Ira Schnapp.
Hmm.
I think he is going to retire, I think, just in a matter of months. Once again, not fired or whatever. We, just so you know or whatever, because I know we've talked around this issue a couple times or whatever about this sort of artistic purge from DC.
Yep.
That's actually a couple months in the future. So when I say people like Murphy Anderson, Ira Schnapp are departing, it's generally under their own steam at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we will definitely address, you know, when the actual, you know, editorially mandated departures occur. So this cover, like I say, you know, Neil Adams, and, you know, I'll let you describe it. What are your overall impressions of this?
It looks like a really scary scene. What I'm looking at is Spectre looking like he's being defeated. The colors are really vibrant on here, and the bad guy looks like he's just like lording it over Spectre.
Yeah, it's like I say, it's definitely a departure, I think, you know, from that Silver Age ethic. You know, I think this stands in stark contrast, you know, to the Murphy Anderson stuff. As you say, you know, it really conveys a sense of like terror as this bad guy's lording it over, you know, and we get a whole sort of like horde of demons, you know, coming from the back. And I think you even mentioned before that is an Adams trait, right, on that Lois Lane cover. You were saying like the sort of background stuff
mm-hmm.
really sort of pops. But interestingly, right, look up at the logo. And what was the other thing that we said had the... Oh, Strange Adventures, right? We were saying how the art on Strange Adventures cover kind of stood in contrast to the old-fashioned logos,
mm-hmm.
right? Whose art is that right next to the Spectre logo?
Murphy Anderson?
Murphy Anderson, exactly. They were the only other artist, I guess, in the, you know, the Silver Age who would have drawn him, right? So they're still using that, you know, that Murphy Anderson headshot, you know, in an old-fashioned logo on a clearly more modern cover image. And the Irish Schnapp, you know, lettered text here on the bottom says, Die, Spectre, again and again. And again.
Wow.
Let's crack this open and see if he dies, you know, again and again.
And again.
And again. So we begin on a full-page splash, you know, credited, right? Story by Gardner Fox, art by Neil Adams, as we see a sort of, like, you know, Mandrake-inspired magician, you know, clocking out the Spectre in a couple different action shots. We sort of get the sort of, like, cinematic motion, you know, from not even panel to panel, just like, you know, motion in a single image.
The background of the splash page looks great. His artwork's incredible.
Yeah, right. And I think this might be the baddie's, you know, face superimposed on the whole action. He's just cackling in the back, ha 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 ha. As our narration tells us that stage magician Dirk Rawley had a good thing going for him. While performing before an audience, they supplied him with a perfect alibi for the robberies simultaneously being committed offstage by his other self. And while Detective Jim Corrigan ran up against a stone wall trying to solve the impossible crimes, his own spectral self ran headlong into the thief, only to fall victim to his eerie powers. Die, Spectre... .. again. And so with that foreboding intro, you know, we turn the page to be dropped into the middle of the action, as our narration tells us that footfalls are a lonely sound on a deserted street in Gateway City, when the otherwise silent night is shattered by, "This is a stick-up," says some baddie. "Hand over your valuables or I shoot." "Shoot with what?" says our, you know, victim. You don't have a gun." "You want a gun? Presto, you have a gun," as zip, a gun, you know, goes into the guy's, you know, formerly empty hand.
That's freaky.
Yes. Swift as is the action of the powerful holdout spring that shoots the gun into the hand of the holdup man. Oh, so that's one of those old, like, right, you know, where Robert De Niro's like, "You talking to me?" And he's got that gun. They go to say he's got one of those, like, swivel gun things or whatever. But even swifter is the hand of his victim as, you know, our guy getting hauled up, you know, fights back with that chunk, you know, hitting the baddie across the face. "If you make like a magician, so can I. See, my hand is quicker than your gun." As apparently his hand stabs through the air at the flying gun. And to complete the turnabout, it is the would-be robber who's now menaced. You're going to shoot me?" says the robber on the ground. But suddenly, there's a burst of brilliance, followed by a gloved fist striking from behind, as our, you know, victim who is now holding the robber on the ground is whumped in the back of the neck. "Oh," he says. As our robber, you know, scrambles to his feet and looks at, you know, his savior. "That man, he's dressed exactly as I am, except he has no face." As indeed, now we see the guy who hit him in the back, mm-hmm. and it's like they're both wearing becoming purple suits.
Yes.
So, "Look upon me closely, Dirk Raleigh," says this, you know, faceless man or whatever, which, how's he speaking with no mouth? But, what are you?" asks Dirk Raleigh. But as the dazed Dirk Raleigh stares in stark amazement, he sees a slow change come upon the featureless flatness of his rescuer's face. "Gaze upon my blank face, give me an identity, and you'll see who I am." As this sort of, like, I guess, changeling creature, you know, turns into a exact duplicate of Dirk Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
You're me, but how? "I'm your etheric self, Dirk Raleigh. Your emotional state, brought about by an intense fear of being killed, has at long last released the etheric body, which has always been a part of you. Now, I know you do some meditation. Is this true? Can you do this? Can you go commit robberies on our behalf?" So I'm taking you from your laugh that's a no.
No.
but at least in this story, you know, it is true because this little, you know, etheric guy's like, "I breathe, I live. Farewell for now, Dirk Raleigh. I go to the ancient, demon-haunted town of Arkham to bathe in the evil emanations which form a vicious vortex there and gather strength. But we shall meet again," as etheric Dirk Raleigh sort of, like, you know, clasps his hands in a very sort of dramatic, you know, Neil Adams stippled pose,
yeah.
backlit. And it's actually quite nice in the lighting too, right? You know, we have the, I guess he's lit from the moonlight from behind or whatever, mm-hmm. sort of cast into a yellow, you know, highlight. It's quite nice. So some nights later, you know, as we cut to a different scene, the great vaults of Gateway City Bank are looted, followed by the theft of the fabulous Soames gem collection from a sealed chest, without breaking the seals. Let me hear some conversation. "There's no way for the vault to have been opened before the time mechanism released the bolts. The theft couldn't have taken place, but it did. The chest was sealed with wax, and though the wax was unbroken, the jewels were somehow taken out of it." So, assigned to cover these impossible crimes is Detective Captain Jim Corrigan, who's now stymied every turn. Was he a detective captain last time we saw him?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know his rank or whatever. We'll assume he was. So we see, I guess, Jim getting the lowdown as the guy's telling him, "These gems have been stolen, which means there had to have been a thief." "Well, really, dude?" "It's up to the police to find him," as Jim's thinking. "Not a clue. Absolutely nothing to go on." And apparently this case is just one more thing on Jim's plate, because our narration says that to Captain Corrigan's regular police duties have been added an additional assignment, that of chairman of the annual policeman's ball. And we see Jim looking at his watch, thinking, "It'll be a relief to take a break from that case. An evening with Mona and a fresh start in the morning." I saw the Mona thing and it kind of reminded me that... not Mona Honey, right? That's the Eclipso thing, right? This is Mona Marcy, right? Mm-hmm. From the Ghost of Ace Chance thing, that sort of heiress or whatever that he hooked up with. Yeah. I guess they're continuing that thread.
Yeah. And just getting back to this, because you had asked, you know, like, was he a captain before?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think that they used to refer to him as Detective Corrigan.
Detective Corrigan.
And not Captain Corrigan.
Yeah. I'm trying to think back to the Golden Age. Like, what was he? He certainly wasn't a captain back then because he was always reporting to the captain. Mm. So, yeah, I don't know. But, meh, whatever. Okay, he's detective captain. So, what do? We cut to the this policeman's ball as we see that out of the night swoops the spirit sleuth, that ghostly guardian of goodness. Oh, my God. This is definitely Gardner Fox.
Wow.
Yeah. He who fights evil and injustice across the world... The Spectre, as you know, Corgan looks up and there's his, you know, his ghostly other self, you know, haunting the grounds. "Well, welcome home," says Corgan. "I thought you were off on a case of your own with the Justice Society." "I was, Jim, but the case was an exhausting one. I need a rest in our body." and that is why we didn't do this last week.
Yeah, you couldn't have done that.
Right, so... Our narration says, "The Spectre, given life by mystic powers of a voice which explained that his work was not yet done, the ghost of dead Jim Corrigan, slain by gangster Gat Benson, became a spirit being dedicated to the prevention of crime and the apprehension of wrongdoers. When Detective Jim Corrigan was also raised from the dead to live again as his former self, there began a strange twin existence of man and spirit united, yet disunited." Is that what a word? Disunited?
It is now.
both dedicated to stamping out evil. So yeah, the second paragraph there, which says when Jim Corrigan was also raised from the dead, that was the story we read with Percival Pop. Remember? The Corrigan body had been dead and was the Spectre, but then when the Corrigan body was raised, now they're two different people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, and these two different people are talking as you know, Corgan's protesting, Spectre climbing inside, saying, "Wait, I'm going on a date with Mona Marcy. Couldn't you arrange to at least let us have some privacy?"
"Nope."
"Okay," says the Spectre. "I'll leave you on your own as soon as I restore my psychic energies within you."
That's so creepy.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what he does, right? He has to recharge, you know, his like, I guess, etheric self. And I think later on, there's actually a series in between the 70s revival and then that John Ostrander thing I told you. There's, maybe like 12 to 15 issues of a really short run series by a writer by the name of Doug Munch, I want to say is how you pronounce his name, who made that a key plot point, that the Spectre could only be separated for like a matter of hours, and if he was, he'd start getting weak and then dissipating or whatever. I'm pretty sure that was like addressed at some point. So we turn the page, and Reader's Rendezvous. We're actually going to hold off on this. I don't want to read any of these letters or whatever, but there is an editor's note here that I want to address, but at the end of the story, so we'll come back to this page. Don't let me forget.
Right on.
So we resume as the door opens and we see a wealthy society woman, Mona Marcy, beaming on the man who first entered her life while investigating the death of Ace Chance. It wasn't the death of Ace Chance, it was the ghost of Ace Chance.
Ghost, yeah.
"So, Mona, you look gorgeous," says Jim, as he thinks, "I should have told my other self about the impossible crimes case, but while he's inside of me, he'll find out about it quickly enough." Apparently, I guess revealing some of the you know, inner workings of the Spectre life. Mm-hmm, he emerges and learns, you know, what Jim knows. So an hour later, at the benefit ball, we see Jim introducing Mona to the star performer of the evening. As he says, "This is Dirk Raleigh, whose feats of magic will astonish, and I hope please our guests." What a strange way to phrase that. "Which will astonish, and I hope please." When you say, "Which will please, and I hope astonish."
Yeah,
that's very strange. As all this is going on, I guess we hear the thoughts of the Spectre inside Jim as he's thinking, "Jim thinks these impossible crimes were the work of a clever criminal, but I sense they are psychic manifestations of some spirit creature. No mortal man could have performed such deeds. Only a spirit body could have stolen the money and the gems in that manner."
Mm. Good point, Spectre.
"I'll visit the scene of both crimes, seek out a clue to the culprit." So with Jim Corrigan's knowledge planted firmly in his own mind, we see the discarnate detective speeding away to the vault of the Gateway City Bank. "Yes," he says as he comes in, we see, you know, sort of like etheric waves, you know, penetrating the vault.
Mm-hmm.
"The scent of eerie evil still lingers here. I'll spread a psychic light across the vault, have it reveal where the thieving spirit being made contact." But as that pallid spirit radiance seeps across the vault, says the Spectre, I guess, like, being torn apart.
Stretched, yeah.
"It was the work of an etheric being, the sinister energies that filled this vault, tugging at my very existence." So the eldritch forces in the vault tear at the ghostly guardian like a thaumaturgic tornado. Gardner Fox. I'm being wrenched apart. My ectoplasmic energy shredded. I must escape this evil flux or perish. Again. He doesn't say again. That was an addition. And so, you know, with a furious lunge, we see the specter breaking free of that awesome aura as he thinks, I've never experienced anything like that. Look at how, like, firmly resolved Spectre looks. He's, like, all gritting his teeth.
Yeah.
You know, this is just for the benefit of folks. We haven't really been describing the art, but this is, you know, the sort of Neil Adams, you know, style that we saw. You know, the sort of, like, you know, modified panels, a little bit of experimentation, you know, definitely, you know, action-focused. But kind of interesting, you know, like, and, you know, we had talked a little bit about this, you know, with regard to, you know, the contrast in Murphy Anderson. But I don't know, Spectre, you know, should have that sort of otherworldly thing. Here he looks a little more grounded, right? He's almost like drawing him almost like Dead Man in a sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah, if you change his costume, yeah.
Yeah, really.
Musculature and, yeah.
Yeah, just put like a red cape on him. Yep. And yeah, remove the cowl. But in any case, what happens? We see the Spectre whooshing away, thinking, those evil energies exist only within the vault. I can't utilize them to track down the one who caused them. Perhaps I will fare better at the Soames crime site. So within moments, we see the spirit sleuth staring down at the looted jewel chest in the Soames mansion. The force still hovers here, but confined, leaving me no way to trace it. Wait, suddenly I sense an extension of this same force coming from another place. So a nebulous curtain of radiant psych energy appears to the Spectre. The etheric beam who left the evil flux here at the chest is now engaged in more evil. Elsewhere, for that is a consciousness curtain emanating from an etheric body in action, just as lightning leaves a trail of ionic air to reveal its presence. Now, Spectre really engages in some deep thoughts. Exactly. So the very next moment, we see that the etheric trail leads to a museum where it has the form of the magician Jim just introduced to Mona. What's this? Says this etheric magician form. The spirit sleuth, known as the Spectre. If you are here on business, I advise you to stand clear of me, and I won't harm you.
Oh.
I'm here on official business, and you're it, says the Spectre, grabbing hold of him. The sooner I finish it, the better I will like it. Take your ghostly hands off me, ghost. Oh, no, take your ghastly hands off me, ghost. Take your ghastly hands off me, ghost. Or do I have to demonstrate my powers are far superior to yours? As he thinks to himself. My stay in demonic Arkham Town served to make me the most powerful being in the universe. Well, that was convenient. Nothing can stand me, living or otherwise, he says, you know, whipping out of the Spectre with apparently a bolt of energy that says, Katak. His cloak, everything about him filled with eerie energies, repelling me, says the Spectre, you know, getting repelled. And now, Spectre, I'm going to pull a rabbit out of my hat. Says this, you know, magician pulling off his hat and indeed pulling out a, I guess, energy form rabbit.
I was going to say, is that like an etheric rabbit?
Yeah. And he throws it at the Spectre. Keep your eye on the rabbit, Spectre. It's growing larger and larger. You might call that blow a rabbit punch, he says, as the rabbit, like, you know, kicks Spectre in the face. That rabbit's full of the same evil etheric energy against which my own spectral abilities are seemingly useless. So summoning up the powers of good, with which his body is imbued, the disembodied detective grasps the ruthless rabbit and, oh, good Lord. This is, you know, maybe we need to take another week off. I don't know if I'm ready for Gardner Fox's, you know, alliterative prose. Good gives me the added strength, but it's only a temporary thing, thinks the Spectre. Must quickly overcome that etheric body before. But before he even can finish his thought, you know, our etheric magician, you know, pulls another trick. Ha-ha! A bouquet of flowers up my sleeve, bearing that sweet smell of defeat for the Spectre. But before, you know, this magician can throw those flowers, you know, those energy flowers, I guess, you know, at Spectre or whatever, Spectre repels them, you know, back with an energy bolt of his own. But there, you know, our magician returns. It's my deal again, Spectre, as I change the name of our game. He makes a, I guess, etheric deck of cards, you know, appear in his hand and sort of shuffles them outward at the Spectre. The cards growing large as did the rabbit, and the figures on it coming alive, attacking me. As indeed we see all the sort of like face cards, you know, the jacks and the kings, you know, peeling off these giant cards and becoming like, you know, spectral knights, I guess, to fight the Spectre.
So weird.
Those cards look like big sails, and sails wrapped to the wind. I'll blow up a storm, as he takes a big, you know, I guess spectral breath, apparently, and slams the cards into one another, you know, I guess defeating this most recent onslaught. So, though racked with psychic weakness, the specter staggers toward the loot-happy foe. Almost forgot what brought me here, says, fake Raleigh, to gather up these art treasures. And he starts, peeling paintings off the wall. I refuse to concede that his powers are stronger than mine, says the specter. You know, I guess tired of all the etheric battles and just resorting to a punch. He gives the etheric magician a swack.
Jim Corrigan style.
Jim Corrigan style, exactly. As Raleigh falls to the floor, you know, saying, if you insist on a fight to the finish, so be it. You know, he says, turning and, I guess, blasting out another bolt. Die, Spectre, again, he says, titularly.
Yeah.
So, writhing and twisting, the very... Oh, no, that's not a bolt of energy. That's the...
the scarves.
The scarves all tied together, exactly. So we see this...
I thought the same thing.
The endless scarves, you know, coming out and, I guess, wrapping up the Spectre. As our narration tells us that writhing and twisting, the very colored sash twines about the struggling body of the discarnate detective. This thing is like an etheric snake. No way to tear it loose. It's too strong for me. Is this the end? The end.
Probably.
The end of what? You're
probably
already
the
dead.
End.
So one part of me is still free to move. What part is that? Oh, it's his foot.
Yep, left foot.
So we see his boot stamping the floor. As in answer to that outpouring of psychic energy, we see astral flames leaping upwards. A spirit flame to burn a spirit sash. Oh, that's pretty clever. He's lighting the etheric scarves on fire. But by the time the specter bursts free of the blazing satin, he's gone. And since he's no longer in action, I have no way of following him. Because, of course, you know, he's leaving like an etheric trail.
Mm-hmm.
So we turn our page and we see later, you know, in the privacy of Corrigan's bedroom... The specter's just sort of like floating, you know, cross-legged over...
Very creepy.
...over Jim's bed. You say you tangled with the person responsible for the impossible crimes, asks Corrigan. Well, don't just sit there. Tell me, who was he? Dirk Raleigh, says the specter. The magician? But that's as impossible as the impossible crimes. He was at the ball all night long. I saw him. Nevertheless, he was robbing an art museum. At least, his etheric body was. What in thunder's an etheric body, says Corrigan. You should know, brother. It's a spirit counterpart of the human body, which it resembles, usually subject to the commands of its physical double. By changing its density, an etheric double can pass through solid walls, yet keep itself solid enough to pick up tangible objects. By surrounding these solid objects with its aura, it's able to transport them through walls.
Okay, says Corrigan. I'll buy that, if you say so. Now tell me, how do we stop this crook?
That's what I've been mulling over. There's a chance that if you hit the physical Dirk Raleigh at the same time I hit his etheric body, we may knock it out of existence.
Please.
So the next time the etheric double strikes, it'll be your job to land a KO punch the very instant I do.
That's weird hearing the specter say KO punch.
Yeah, it is.
So in a very creepy panel, you know, as
it's incredibly creepy.
The Spectre's like climbing, because it looks like Spectre's climbing into bed with Corrigan, but but he's actually going into his body or
which
whatever.
Which is creepier.
Yeah. He says,
"Now let's both get some sleep and rest up for our ordeal to come."
As our story continues on the third page following.
You know what else makes this panel look really creepy?
What
is it? Spectre's so huge, and Jim Corrigan looks really frightened.
He does.
He's like, terrified.
No, don't do this. It's just like, I don't want to be like, you know, like untoward or whatever, but actually it kind of looks like, you know, one of those like, you know, like show us on the doll where the specter climbed into
right?
or
yeah.
something.
I mean,
know?
It's
horrible. So as we turn our page, I actually am going to pause on this for a second because it's actually kind of funny. I saw this when I was flipping through. I mentioned, you know, Neil Adams, whatever, you know, is brand new to this title. So apparently in order to introduce him, you know, to the readership or whatever, they put together this little text feature in which the Spectre interviews Neil Adams.
Okay.
So do you want to pause a moment and like
sure.
go through this or whatever?
Yeah.
Just for the benefit of our listeners, you know, at the top of it, you know, we see the Spectre, you know, as drawn by Neil Adams, sort of, you know, pointing at Adams himself, you know, with a finger, like, you know, demanding, you know, what's going on here.
Index finger, just so you're not confused.
Yeah, and then the rest of it, you know, is just a sort of, you know, back and forth conversation here. As the Spectre says, born. And Neil Adams says, right. Hey, that first question was easy. This interview business is a snap. Next question.
I'd like to know if you're interested in drawing my
Sure. Then you better stop wising off and answer these questions straight. Because if you don't, Julie, that is to say, Editor Schwartz, might not consider having you draw it.
You got me there, Spec, says Neil Adams. I'd be honored to draw the new magazine you appear in.
Good. Then when were you born?
June 15th, 1941, says Adams.
That makes you 26.
Quick thinking there, Spec. I was born here in New York and lived here most of my life. One sister, born at the same place, accompanied me with much screaming, clawing through my childhood, and...
Wait a minute. Let's get back to this 26-year-old thing.
Hmm?
What I mean to say is, at 26, how much experience can you have? I mean, isn't that a rather ambitious undertaking for one with so little experience?
Well, I have gotten around a bit. For example, I did do some work for a competing company that produces a comic mag about a red-headed, freckled teenager who will remain unnamed, but obviously we talked about...
Archie,
exactly. When I was 18.
That must have been when you got out of high school.
Yeah, just. Out of high school and right back into high school with this kid with the weird haircut.
What then?
Well, then I was an assistant on a comic strip based on the Bat Masterson TV series. Oh, you were right. It was a TV series. let's see. I did backgrounds and stuff like that. Afterwards, I entered the advertising field and did ads for such clients as ESO, which I think is the...
Gas.
Yeah, it's formerly... Or that's what Exxon used to be, right?
Oh, I don't know.
Are they two different? I don't know.
I think either. They're separate.
Let's see. Miles Shoes, Time Magazine, National Guard, Bell Telephone, Norelco, Tintex, American Machine, and Foundry, Avon Cosmetics.
Oh, very impressive.
Interrupts the Spectre.
But interesting as that kind of work is, there's something special needed for comics, especially one like the Spectre, and especially following upon the great work of Murphy Anderson. Have you had any experience doing comics outside of that previously mentioned?
Well, I did do a syndicated comic strip for 3.5 years.
What? For what?
A comic strip based on the Ben Casey TV series.
But 3.5 years.
You want to hear a cool bit? Asked Adams. If I had sold that comic strip a few months sooner, I'd have to bring my mother down to sign the contract because I wasn't 21 and not of legal age. I mean, you got to be 21 to sign a contract?
I don't think that's true now, but maybe at the time.
Hmm.
But how could you do a comic strip and still do advertising? I mean, a lot of cartoonists need assistance to help them, and you're just doing a single strip.
Well, it works like this, says Adams. When I go to sleep, my right hand rests, but my left hand just keeps drawing.
Is that so?
Probably not.
You know, I have a similar affliction, except in my case, my quote-unquote left hand is Jim Corrigan, my human alter ego.
Say, I wondered about that, says Adams. When you two merge like that, do you, like, go to sleep, or does Corrigan keep you awake when he's awake?
That's difficult to say. Sometimes I think that, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be interviewing you. Now, when did your comic strip end?
About a year ago, says Adams, and that's when I came here to National Comics.
Do you work for other editors around here?
I thought you knew. I work for Murray Boltonoff on Bob Hope and Jerry Lewis, and I work with Jack Miller on the new Deadman, they've made it two words, Deadman, in Strange Adventures, and occasionally I do a Superman cover for Mort Weisinger. And of course, I've done a couple war stories for Bob Kanigher. This is nice, actually. This is, like, everything that we did in our, like, sort of Neil Adams wrap-up, you know, when we first... It's all covered here.
Hold it, hold it, hold it, says the Spectre. With all that stuff, how could you possibly find time to do the Spectre?
Well, you know, that's funny, says Adams. That's exactly what Julius Schwartz was saying to me the other day when he stood behind my drawing board, jingling the loose change in his pocket. He boomed down on me with that basso profundo voice of his, like a foghorn in the night, bellowing out his rage in the fog or some other mischance of nature. How in the blue blazes are you going to do my Spectre story with all the other work you have to do around here? Of course, he calmed down and he gave me the script right after I assured him that I would use my right hand on Spectre and my left hand on the other jobs. I forget whether I mentioned this at the beginning of our show, but let me just say it right here. It's kind of funny that they're saying that about Julius Schwartz because honestly, if I'm remembering correctly, in order to edit the Spectre, Julius Schwartz himself actually had to give up another book, and I'm pretty sure it was Hawkman. I think that he passed that off to maybe George Kashtan. But Spectre's like,
what? You mean you've already been given a script to work on for my magazine? Then why in the Spirited Sorceries of Arkham am I interviewing you?
You're not, Spec, says Neil Adams. I'm interviewing you. I've got to get a little background material on you. After all, look at how much of the issue I've already finished.
Well, since you've already begun, try
try to keep my cape as straight as Murphy Anderson did, and maybe the readers won't mind the change.
So it's okay. Rather a little meta there, right? You know, yeah. Like for the folks who are like, you know, where's Murphy Anderson? Mm-hmm. You know, you respond, hey, join up the army. You can see his work every day. So, and then on our facing page, we've actually already done this, the teeny quiz, you know, the sort of advertisement for Teen Beam, mm-hmm. which a little line in the sand here. And I know I always make promises and don't fulfill them or whatever, but I suspect, you know, if everything goes according to plan, that we will actually take a look at this in our next episode. Uh-huh. So, but for now, let's turn our page and get back into our story. As we see some days later, just as Jim Corrigan's about to leave for police headquarters, you know, his phone's ringing. Mona, how nice to hear from you. When are we going to get together again? About Friday evening, comes Mona's, you know, voice across the telephone, for the charity union dinner. I'm inviting you to be my escort. Well, I'm very busy right now, says Corrigan. Even if I tell you that magician Dirk Rawley's on the entertainment program, says Mona. That does it, Mona. I'll be happy to take you. Well, I guess they're really into this magician.
Yeah.
And Mona puts down the phone. Odd, Jim didn't seem enthusiastic about our date until I mentioned that magician. Jim never has a second cup of coffee. So we flash forward to the charity union dinner as we see, you know, I assume this is Dirk Rawley, but dressed up in a turban or whatever up on stage. As, you know, Corrigan's thinking, maybe this will be the night that etheric devil will make another appearance, giving Dirk Rawley another perfect alibi. So meanwhile, you know, across the town, we see the discarnate detective following a psychic energy curtain to the fashionable jewelry store on the west end of Gateway City. As we see, you know, Spectre following down this energy trail, you know, apparently, you know, the etheric form of Dirk Rawley. There he is. Now for the knockout punch. Jim, get ready. You know, I guess broadcast Spectre, uh-huh. You know, etherically, you know, across back to the charity dinner. As indeed, there we see, you know, Jim in the middle of taking a spoonful of soup, you know, hearing, Jim, get ready. What? Oh, it's time for double action. I'm closing in, comes the specter's, you know, message directly to Jim's brain. Hurry, get near Rawley. Remember, we have to synchronize our blows.
How weird is this for Mona?
I know, right? Strike our targets at the same instant. As we see, you know, Jim leap up from the table, you know, plunking down his soup. Please excuse me, Mona. Jim, oh my goodness, he's run amok, as we see Jim rushing the stage. Captain Corrigan, says, what's his name again? Jim. Rawley, Dirk Rawley, yeah. Captain Corrigan, what are you trying to do? Now, Jim, now, comes the Spectre's voice as, you know, Jim takes a swing at Rawley. Ugh, he ducked under my fist. But before Jim can strike another blow, calm down, man, the guards, I guess, rush the stage. Let go of me, I have to hit him, says Jim, struggling against him. Corrigan, I'm going to prefer charges against you for this unwarranted attack, you know, says Rawley, you know, pointing at him all angrily. But even as Jim struggles savagely to reach his quarry, the disembodied detective makes contact with Dirk Rawley's etheric devil. Now, Jim, now, says the specter, you know, socking the etheric devil. What's stopping you? Back again for more unfinished business, Spectre, says the devil. All right, let's settle it here and now. And the Spectre suddenly realizes, Jim didn't hit his man. Now I'm really in for it.
Uh-oh.
You've heard of flying carpet, Spectre? Now see one, unlike any you've heard about. It's energized to beat you to a phantom pulp.
See? Can you get beaten by a rug?
Yeah, a phantom rug.
Phantom rug.
Paralyzing my body, sapping my strength, says the Spectre as this rug attacks him. Though racked by evil energy, the Spectre does manage to fling the magical rug away from him, as we see, you know, this sort of, like, extended arm. Yeah, you know, like, I don't know, obviously you're going to have your judgments at the tail end of it or whatever, but I have to say that, you know, obviously this is a hallmark of Murphy Anderson's portrayal of the Spectre, the sort of elongated limbs and then growing and shrinking. I don't know that Adams is capturing it all that well.
No, this looks really weird, but... Yeah, when Murphy Anderson did it, it looked better.
Yeah, I mean, for the benefit of everybody, you know, listening, obviously, you know, I'm a huge fan of Neal Adams, but what we're sort of seeing here is, you know, the trademark of Neal Adams, this sort of very, very realistic artwork, but then all of a sudden, every couple panels, you'll just see a weird sort of surrealistic thing overlaid on top of, you know, otherwise realistic art, and it kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, you
know? Yeah, it does.
So, Spectre, you know, swats away these rugs with, you know, a very, like, strange-looking arm, thinking, with each contact of that energy, I grow weaker. How much longer can I hold out? We'll find out, apparently, on the second page following. As, from his fallen turban, we see the mystic magician pull out a great gem, saying, with this ruby of mighty Thulthum. Oh, Thulthum? What is it? Thulthum? That word yeah, looks Thul-thum. Familiar to me, though. Where do I know Thul-thum from? I feel like there's
It's a Gardner Fox story. Perhaps we've looked it up before.
Yeah, I feel like there's a reference for that. I'm gonna put a pin in that and check it out, like offline or whatever. So he's got the Ruby of Mighty Thul-thum, Wonder Wizard of Dark. What's it? Demonoltries. Demonoltries, yeah. Which I obtained in Arkham Town. Shall I bring about your final doom, Spectre? Grow smaller. Feel the rays shrink you, even as they draw you into the gem created in the spawning ground of time and space. Inside Thul-thum's bewitched gem, there is no escape. In this manner, I condemn you to eternal imprisonment. No more resistance powers left in me, says the Spectre as he's shrinking down into the gem. So his foe encased within the crystalline walls of the right enchanted ruby, the evil ethericism makes his exit. Whew. The task almost exhausted me, thinks the etheric form of Dirk Raleigh. I must return to Arkham, which alone can renew my psychic strength. So, in the long-forgotten streets of ancient Arkham, where walk the earthly shades of warlocks and wizards and their servant demon spirits, comes one who is also Dirk Raleigh. As we see, you know, Dirk, I guess, surrounded by all these, like, you know, evil demon spirits.
Mm-hmm.
The evil in this place is so intense, the evil emanation so strong, I could bathe in them forever. Yea, you demons and you wizards, seep into my psychic pores, strengthen me against all good. I give me of your evil wills and sorceries, he says. Oh, and then now this is reflective of the cover.
Yeah.
Because we see, I guess, you know, Dirk Raleigh.
In the serpent chair.
Yes, is taking up his place in the serpent throne as all these, like, you know, demons, you know, fly inside of him. As our narration says that in a grim old manse that once belonged to a sect of demon worshippers, the etheric being recuperates. When I wake to serve my physical other self, I will be the most potent force in and out of this celestial sphere. With the specter imprisoned in the enchanted ruby, I need fear no other thing. The world is redness in the eyes of the ghostly guardian, says our narration, as he flings himself back and forth within his corundum cell. Is that a corundum? Is that a gem or something?
Mm-mm.
You don't know that word?
I don't.
Yeah. As the specter thinks, just as a blob of mercury can cause an object to roll about when the mercury moves, so I can move this ruby. I can roll it hither and yon in this room, but to what avail? That's a little bit of science says you're wrong going on there.
Yeah.
Gardner Fox's little, like, you know.
Slipping in another fact.
Yeah. That diamond, says the specter, is spying another gem. Raleigh's etheric double dropped it when I punched him. Diamond is the hardest of all substances. If I can get up enough speed. I can think of what he's trying to do is, like, shatter the ruby.
Yeah.
But as indeed he thinks, no possibility of shattering the ruby, but if I can just scratch it. So again and again, he hurls the red gem against the blue-white stone until, did it, a deep enough scratch, weakening the crystalline structure of the gem. Now to find another hard object around here. So, the next moment, that fast-rolling ruby shatters against a cast-iron radiator. This never would have happened if Jim Corrigan hadn't failed me. Oh, come on, Spectre. Aww. Give him a break. I better lock him up, find out why. Lock him? Oh, look him up.
That's kind of harsh.
So, at this moment, Detective Captain Jim Corrigan faces troubles of his own, as we see, you know, Corrigan getting chewed out.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, Corrigan, that was the most reprehensible conduct ever displayed by a police officer. You're suspended from all duties while you await departmental trial. That's telling him, Commissioner Hackett. Says, who's that? Just like...
some guy.
In a tie, I guess maybe like the police commissioner. No, that's the commissioner. Maybe that's the mayor or something like that. Time to turn in your badge, Corrigan, you know, says the commissioner. Yes, sir, says Corrigan, handing over his badge. Looks like Jim tried to connect with Raleigh, but didn't quite make it, says the specter, you know, entering in through the wall. So later, you know, after Jim has driven Mona Marcy home, the entire story comes out. And we see Jim and the specter riding side by side in the car. Weird. It's very weird. Didn't you even try to explain why it was so urgent for you to hit Raleigh?
What would he have said?
No. Are you kidding, says Corrigan? All I had to do was say Dirk Raleigh's etheric body was out robbing for him while his physical body was in here, and they'd throw me in a loony bin. At least this way, I'm still here to help you out, if I can. No ifs about it, says the specter. You will help me, or I'm done for. To add to our difficulties, it will be even harder to overcome our foes next time. Since Raleigh's been tipped off about our manner of attack, he'll do everything he can to avoid being hit by you when I clash against his etheric self. Use all your skills. Everything depends on you. So,
For the next 2 days, the suspended detective captain trails the stage magician without success until one night, you know, we see at the Gateway Playland amusement park. Going into this amusement park, eh? Thinks Corrigan. Is he trying to have some fun at my expense? As in his mind, he hears the voice of the specter. Jim, I've made contact with the ether curtain, which reveals Rolly's double is in action. I'm ready whenever you are, specter, thinks Corrigan. As he looks at the real Rolly, and he's like, He keeps looking at his watch. Something's up, all right. I better keep close to him. So the next moment, we see, taking an airplane ride, huh? Even if it gets close to the 11th hour. You gotta take a flyer, too, he says, you know, going toward the airplane ride. Hold it, mister, says the, I guess, the carnival barker who runs this ride or whatever. You'll have to wait for the next ride. But that'll be too late, thinks Corrigan. I can't fail Spectre again. Neil Adams really likes this sort of, like, carnival imagery, right?
Yeah. You know,
like, all the dead man stuff is kind of coming to play here. So we turn our page and, you know, we see his face etched in dismay. Jim looking at his quarry, spinning out of reach. Jim, comes the voice of the specter in his head. I see the etheric double. Hurry, get within hitting distance of Dirk Rolly. And Corrigan's like frantic. He's like, how can I get close to him when he's way up there and I'm way down here? Are you set, Jim? I'll give you a 20-second countdown. At zero, hit him hard. The specter's really just like being, unreasonable here. I got an idea, says Corrigan. I have a friend not far from here. 20, comes the voice. Ed, you gotta help me, he says, running up to the guy running the human cannonball exhibit.
Wow.
I read about your trouble with the police commissioner, Jim. I shouldn't do it, but out of our old friendship, get in. 13, 12, comes the voice of the specter. So we see a sort of, you know, trademark Neil Adams sequence, you know, basically just close-ups on the imagery. You know, we see, what is this, a close-up of the, I guess, the cannonball mechanism, exactly. And then, you know, Corrigan's hand, Corrigan's foot. It's actually kind of a nice little sequence. Uh-huh. But then we see a ridiculous panel. Corrigan wearing the human cannonball helmet, you know, as he's climbing into the cannon. Aim the cannon at that airplane ride, Ed, and don't miss. 7.
Wow.
6. With a baroom, you know, the human cannonball thing, fires Jim Corrigan through the sky toward Rolly, you know, in the airplane ride. Oh no, I'm gonna miss him, says Corrigan. 2-0, comes the voice of the specter, as indeed it all comes together at the last moment. Corrigan grabs out for the airplane ride and swings around, you know, and swocks the real Rolly right in the face with a contact. Credit where credit's due. Ridiculous sequence, but totally. Once again, nice Neil Adams motion,
yes.
Right? Like, static panel, but, you know, all this dynamism, whatever, you kind of capture, you know, Jim's motion. I find it somewhat interesting, though, and I'm going to point this out as well. We talked before about Neil Adams sort of being grounded in reality. During this whole sequence, Spectre's off with the etheric form. Corrigan's here, you know, down on Earth. Which one's Adams focusing on?
Well, the Earth guy.
The Earth guy, exactly, because that...
Oh, because he can't really draw the specter
stuff, yeah. Right, exactly. So this is more like, you know, his wheelhouse, I guess, is the, you know, sort of like grounded action shots, you know. So, but, you know, to belie my statement here, we see at this very instant, some miles away, you know, we see uh-huh. The image of the specter, I guess, hitting.
Like an inset.
Yeah, the etheric form, you know, at the exact same moment that Corrigan hits the real guy. As we turn our page and we see that, you know, after those simultaneous blows thud home, we see the, you know, etheric form, you know, all knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
It worked, thinks the specter. Now to imprison this etheric body in a more escape-proof cell than the one it prepared for me. So soon after, in Wizard Ensorcelled Arkham, we see the spirit sleuth performing a special rite and incantation to combat the evil emanations of the demons and fiends that flock about. The psychic radiation of goodness will seal off the etheric body from the evil upon which it feeds. Without that evil to sustain him, he will lie inert for all time.
Mm.
So, at police headquarters, a little later, you can't hold me, says Rolly. I haven't done anything. How about it, Corrigan, says the commissioner. Do you have any proof Dirk Rolly's a thief? If you hope to clear yourself, you better produce it. I have proof, commissioner, says the specter, you know, coming through the wall. Here's the loot. His etheric self stole, which I found in Arkham. And he comes in, arms full of, like, paintings and jewels and such. But no district attorney in the world would hope to convince a jury that it was a physical Dirk Rolly that forced his so-called etheric twin to commit those robberies, says the commissioner rather, you know, expositorily. But I came prepared for that, says the specter. Let me introduce Hubert Desmond, the first hold-up victim of Dirk Rolly and his etheric duplicate. He He's been in the hospitals ever since their attack. I'm prepared to testify that Dirk Rowley robbed me, says Hubert Desmond. From the very beginning of the story. Yeah. It's your word against mine, says Rowley, and I deny it. You can't deny it. When you're wearing my stolen watch, says Hubert. Your watch? There's nothing on it to prove it's yours. Commissioner, please open the back of the watch, says Hubert. And sure enough, it had his name on it. As they pop it open and says, what? Made especially for Hubert Desmond. What a strange engraving.
That, that's totally weird.
That's all the proof we need to put Rowley away, says the commissioner. And so after, we see Dirk Rowley, you know, being booked for robbery. You see the commissioner, you know, shaking Jim's hand. What can I say, Jim? Except that naturally, your rank is restored, and congratulations on a job well done. I'm grateful all my cases aren't as tough as this one, says Corrigan. To echo my other self, thinks the specter, I'm also grateful all my cases aren't as tough as this one. And the end.
Okay.
As we end on a, I guess, two-third page, you know, with the final, you know, third on the bottom being another advertisement for Teen Beam, the only 12-cent Now Mag in full groovy color. A Monkees Family album. So, as I said, we're gonna do a little teen spotlight next time around or whatever. I know I've been promising some of that Scooter stuff and, you know, Teen Beam, and then I kind of want to get into Teen Titans a little bit, so we'll use the next episode to bridge that gap between Magic and this whole wave. But before we do that, like I said, I did want to go back a little bit, you know, back
to the
letters page just real quick. Because I'm not going to read this letter or whatever, but I did want to read the editorial response because it gives a little bit of background on both the past and the future of this title. Like I say, this is issue 2, and already, you know, we've seen the main artist, you know, off the book, and in very short order, you know, the writer, Gardner Fox. Now, looping this back into what we were saying about the beginning, about the transition from silver to bronze, Gardner Fox is going to be off this title also. So I just want to read this little response, you know, as I guess somebody wrote in and gave a sort of analysis about Spectre, so on and so forth, you know, as I guess almost everyone who writes in feels the need to do. And the editor says, your spectral analysis was so well done, it leaves it squarely up to us to realize the Ghostly Guardian's full potential. We'd like your and other readers' reactions to this issue's villain and to the artwork of Neil Adams. To our regret, Murphy Anderson is no longer able to handle the artistic assignment on the Spectre, but to our delight, we've discovered a very capable replacement. I don't know that that's necessarily true that he wasn't able to handle it. You know, as I said, you know, Murphy had things of his own he was trying to pursue. You can find the lowdown on this artist later in the issue, the Spectre interviews Neil Adams, which we already looked at. Speaking of new talent, fans, there'll be a new writer on next issue's Spectre-ocular novel, co-starring Wildcat, one of your very own, Mike Friedrich. Castro Mike left his California Valley this past summer to hole up in New York City and take a crack at comic magazine writing. He, as well as we, anxiously await your verdict. Mike is no longer a judge, he is to be judged.
Oh.
Now, do you remember who Mike Friedrich is?
Didn't he write in on one of these things before?
Exactly. He was the guy in like in Showcase or whatever saying that you shouldn't do Spectre stories or whatever because they're like unable to be done. And the very next writer on this magazine is Mike Friedrich.
I wonder what he's going to do.
So, and you will find out like later in our show. We're not going to do that.
Not in the next episode because we're going to do Teen Beam.
Yeah. Teen Beam. Mm-hmm. But I think actually not in the next handful of episodes or whatever. But eventually we will loop back around to issue 3 and see, you know, the dawn of Mike Friedrich. I don't know. Like, I haven't read that many Friedrich tales, but the ones I have tended to be a little bit wordy and kind of like pie in the sky. So I've never read this Spectre issue, so we'll see how he does. But like I say, that's in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Our present has to deal with Spectre number 2,
mm-hmm.
you know, Die Spectre again.
Mm-hmm.
So without further ado, let me turn it over to you. So, look, if Gardner Fox can do prose, I can do poetry.
It's like somebody's obviously been exposed to Gardner Fox right there.
So what did you think about this this combination of, you know, silver meeting bronze, you know, writing versus art?
I was not a big fan of this particular one.
Mm-hmm.
The Gardner Fox writing style was, you know, there was nothing different about it. It was like the same as it always had been.
Mm.
But I don't know. There's just something, it didn't seem to fit with Spectre, I guess. It just, there was too much alliteration, or maybe I'd been away from Gardner Fox for long enough and I'd like getting back into it was just like a little much for me.
Yeah. Especially, like I say, since we had kind of gone in a different direction with more like modern narratives.
Yeah. Artwork-wise, Neil Adams, like, very realistic, but I think you have a really good point with, like, Spectre should be a little different. He shouldn't look like a guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he looks a little human, right?
Yeah, well, he looks quite a bit human.
Yeah.
You know, and which is fine, except that it's Spectre.
I mean, it's kind of a weird line to walk, because if you think about it, like, so Dead Man is also, you know, a ghost. He's also, like, an etheric being. But I think a little
But he was human.
Yeah, I mean, well, Spectre was human, too, right? But I think the difference maybe is in power set. Like, so Boston Brand, you know, as Dead Man, is kind of, like, grounded. He's got one thing. He possesses people. And, in fact, apart from that, has no real power of his own. He is not on the etheric plane making any difference. In fact, he always bemoans that. He's like, what can I do? You know, I'm just a ghost. You know, whereas the Spectre, as the ghost, has the power. So maybe that's the difference. Maybe Boston Brand is more human because the only way he can affect things is as a human.
Right.
Whereas the Spectre is more like, say, you know, sort of otherworldly.
Right. Yeah. Could be. Let's see. What else? So let's see. The story didn't quite work for me. Oh, and also, character-wise, the Spectre was agitated and, like, really, and he's never really been like that before.
Kind of snippy.
Yeah, kind of. Just kind of just a little bit. Yeah, he had quite a bit of a, he was, like, almost nasty.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, I'm going to kill the bird on this one.
You're going to kill the bird?
Yeah.
You're going to kill him again? And again and again and again. So, all right.
Just once.
Yeah, so, all right. I don't know that there's much more to say about this. I think we kind of did a lot of preliminary discussion and kind of discussion throughout. Yeah, so, what is the future of our show? Like I say, I don't want to make any you know, deep promises. I kind of have a general idea of how we're going to close out this year. I think we might fit in 2 more episodes before Christmas. I think so. We're gonna put this one out, and then in the next episode, like I say, I want to kind of focus on some teen stuff. I want to do Teen Beam, you know, maybe Scooter. I definitely wanted to look at. You know what we want to look at is the animated stuff, the Superman Aquaman Adventure Hour, but specifically as it relates to Teen Titans. And then what I want to do is I want to set up. For Christmas, there's a Teen Titans. I think we even talked about a take on A Christmas Carol.
Oh.
So maybe we can have a holiday, you know, centric, you know, episode or whatever. A little ghosty, you know, but a little teen at the same time. And then that should take us into 2017.
Nice.
So, yeah, congratulations. Let's I don't really say congratulations yet. Let's first get these episodes out and then call it a year. But with that in mind, I think, you know, we're ready to wrap up this one. Before we go, we should probably, you know, once again, address all of our contact information. You know, if you liked this episode, you know, you can find at least 34 others like it at our website, which is
tporpodcast.com.
And, you know, and if you have anything to say about any of those, you know, 34 plus one episodes, you know, you can write us, let us know your questions, comments, complaints, criticisms, or, you know, any other thing you'd like to say at our email address, which is
tporpodcast@gmail.com.
You can follow us on Twitter, which is
@TPORpodcast.
@TPORpodcast. And then you can also follow us on the Facebook.
Yes, on the Facebook.
Right, which, you know, we've been posting, you know, some images and, you know, I'm a little, you know, not a little. I'm a lot behind on the actual episode-specific images, but, you know, I've kind of been in my head, you know, hashing out, you know, some images I want to choose for some of those older episodes. So I think little by little, you know, we'll get that updated as well. If you feel like following us there, you can do so at that address, which is
facebook.com/groups.
No groups. You're gonna get it. I'm gonna teach you this address
now.
So it's facebook.com/TPORpodcast.
facebook.com/TPORpodcast.
You got it. So
I probably won't get it next time though.
And then if you want to subscribe to us, you can do so at a variety of venues, you know, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Podcastpedia, or any podcatcher of your choice. So with that in mind, you know, that wraps up this one. We want to thank you as always for joining us. We hope you had a good time, and we hope to see you here next time on the Parliament of Rooks podcast.
Thanks, everybody.
That's not me. I go.
I'm not.